All right, welcome back to episode 9 of Solving Systems.
Yeah, welcome back, everyone. Thanks for returning.
Yeah, it's the penultimate episode of this season.
Here we go.
Yes, and today we're going to talk about something interesting. We're going to talk about something that...
Well, we always talk about something interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing different there.
Yes, but maybe a little bit more in our sweet spot as far as expertise. Not that we are experts.
Right.
But that we're inching ever closer to something that I've studied and that you are certainly extremely qualified to speak about, which is...
Ramsey theory. Wait, no. Okay.
No.
But that's the first place we're going to start here. Okay. What we're actually going to talk about today is... finding order in chaos.
Yes.
And Ramsey theory is the mathematical field that deals with this topic.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to go too far into the math here, but I do want to talk about what this field is.
Yeah, we also don't want to tiptoe around it.
Let's just get right into it.
Yeah.
I'll give you a formal definition. It's concerned with the preservation of structure under partitions. And that's a lot of math jargon right there.
So lay it out
the
best you can for those who not familiar.
Yeah, so the idea is that when you have enough elements, right, you have enough things to process, some particular interesting pattern is guaranteed to emerge.
Okay.
So the idea is when you have enough things, mm-hmm. right, enough data points or something, you will find a pattern.
Okay. So basically what we're talking about here is no matter how chaotic and random a sample seems to appear, that we are basically guaranteed some sense of order within that.
Right. So a classic example from this field in math is when you have 6 people at a party,
mm-hmm.
I guarantee you that I can find 3 people that either all know each other or all don't.
So it seems sort of counterintuitive.
Yeah. You think about it and you can kind of envision it, right? You can
sure.
be like, okay, yeah, I guess you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
But... I can say for sure there will be 3 people who either know each other or don't.
And before we get too heavy into this, I hope everyone can appreciate the beauty of mathematics in this moment, which is not only can we, it seems pretty reasonable, math allows us to rigorously say this is definitely true. So one of the beauties of mathematics from a math teacher standpoint is to be able to say things that things are definitely true, and not just we have a pretty good sense that this is right, but to actually know for sure that things are true, which can really help push scientific thought forward.
Right, and that's the thing about math, right? We can prove it, and the things we're going to be talking about today, a lot of them aren't going to be math, and that's where it gets more interesting, I think, because we're trying to apply the concepts from math here, finding order from chaos, and show that they apply to things where you can't prove it.
Yeah, and I also just, an interesting thing here, I think, is we as human beings seek order. I think we're more comforted with order, and especially I think about the institution of religion dating back to, as far as we know, we want to feel like there's a reason things are happening. We want to feel like, this is happening because of this. Or even better, we can predict what will happen next, right? I mean, for how long have we heard, you need to learn history? Why? Well, so that, because history repeats itself, right? That there is some sense of order happening within, the micro scale can be applied to the macro scale. So I think this idea of the fact that there is potentially order within things, even if we can't understand it, but especially if we can, is something that should be comforting to people, as we oftentimes seek order within the seemingly random.
Right. And order is such an important thing for us, right? Because we're always seeking it, like you said.
Always.
And the fact that this applies to so many different fields is what I think makes this interesting. This
Very.
Is probably the most interdisciplinary thing we've talked about.
Yeah, probably.
It really does apply to every system in some degree.
Yes.
And so... yeah, let's just jump into it. Let's go a little bit more with the math side of things, but turn it to random events. This is one of the things I had queued up.
Sure, fire away.
And so, for example, I think this is one of the best examples of this, actually. So you've got, a pair of, you've got die, right, and you roll them.
Yes.
And it seems like it's random, right?
Yeah.
And it is. Every single roll is random. But there's order both on a microscopic and macroscopic level.
Yes.
Right? On the microscopic level, I can guarantee that if you roll this 7 times, that there will be 2 that are the same. Mm. Right? And you can just think about this. This is really easy to envision, right? You roll a 1 and 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 and 6. The next one has to be one of the previous ones.
Exactly.
Right? So you will hit it twice. But then there's the macroscopic order, right? Which is that the long-term behavior is a 1/6 probability of everything.
Yes.
Right? You roll this a million times, you'll approach approximately 1/6 of each.
Basically what casinos are funded by.
Right. Yes. And this is where people, again, when it comes to gambling, people fail. Because then you've got the gambler's fallacy, which is that... which is the belief that macroscopic order applies on a microscopic level.
So I've lost 10 coin flips in a row.
Right.
I should bet big on the next one because I'm bound to win sometime.
Right.
Yes.
And yes, it's true. In the long run, if you keep betting on the same thing,
yes,
you will, you know, reach the average probability for it. But in the short term, every flip, every roll, they're all the same.
And define long term.
Long term.
11 flips is not the long term.
No.
Is 100? Maybe not.
Here's what's interesting. Since we're still in the realm of math, we can prove things. And we can say with, you know, probabilities that, you know, if you roll, you know, if you flip a coin 1,000 times, you're going to approach 50-50.
Of course.
You're not going to hit 50-50, but...
but that's the most likely scenario.
It is.
Yes.
But there is still a non-zero probability of 1,000 heads.
Yes.
So you can't guarantee order.
No.
When it comes to the macroscopic scale at 1,000 flips. You can guarantee it for, you know, as you go to infinity.
But the gambler's fallacy again. If I've had 999 heads, while that is extremely unlikely, if it has happened, it doesn't mean I'm any more likely to get tails on...
well, if you have 999 heads, you probably have an unfair coin. That's why you should bet on heads, honestly.
Probably. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And that would be the one that would be tails.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah.
Of course. Classic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So, again, in math, another one is pseudo-random number generators, right? And there's a reason we have the word pseudo in front of random.
Yes.
And that's because for humans, it looks random.
Yeah.
Right? We don't know what the next number is going to be.
Right.
But the computer does.
Yes.
It's because the computer is actually reading from a string of digits or has some algorithm to compute things.
Yes.
And it just starts at a certain place or starts with a certain feed value.
Yes.
And they call this the seed, right?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing here is that you can give a computer the seed and get the same string of random numbers. Quote unquote random, right?
Yeah, yes.
Because for a human it's random, but for a computer it's not.
Well, yeah, and the best example of this is you buy two new graphing calculators right out of the box, open them up, and you hit, there's a random integer generator on there. You will get the same random, quote, random digits time and time and time again because they're both working off of exactly the same programming, exactly the same seed, right? Mm-hmm. So, And interestingly enough, if we open two calculators, we both type the exact same series of 10 mathematical problems in, and then we generate random integers that will work out exactly the same way. So, this idea of random and pseudo-random is something that every time we generate, quote, random numbers in my classroom, it's not truly random. It is random in the fact that I don't know what's coming next, and yet it's not truly random, right? Which statistically is a different thing.
Right. And another one for math, and I promise we'll get to not math things soon.
They'll hang with us. They've been with us for 8 episodes. They can hang through a little bit of math.
Okay,
I'm sure
good.
Of it. Yes.
one of them is Benford's Law. Now, this is quite possibly the most famous thing we've been talking about here.
Fascinating.
Yeah. This has actually been used in... we're getting outside of math now.
Yeah.
This has been used in court cases to prove fraud, for example.
Yeah, so explain how this works.
Yeah, so the idea here for Benford's Law is that when you have a set of data that involves numbers, the frequency distribution of the leading digits of numbers is interesting. And the idea is that the digit 1 shows up more often than average. It'll show up 30% of the time as the leading digit, while the digit 9 shows up less than 5% of the time. And I guess an intuitive reason for this, and something that it's kind of hard to find online actually because it just delves into math, is that you're more likely to get a number from 1 through 9 than, well, sorry, from 10 to 19 than you are to get a number from 20 to 29. And this is, you know, because data sets tend to skew towards smaller numbers. That's essentially the idea.
Yes.
And you can go into the real math behind it and look at probabilities and stuff. But that's actual math and something we can't talk about here on,
yes,
on a podcast.
That's right.
But the idea, anyway, is that the digit 1 leads a lot of numbers more often. And you can use this in the courtroom because you can say that, okay, here's a data set. Is it a fraud or not? Well, the one of the tests you run on it is you see how frequent the leading digits are, right? Because if somebody is just creating numbers from, you know, from a random number generator, then their leading digits aren't going to be biased toward one.
Exactly.
You can have a lot of nines and eights in there that shouldn't be there.
Yes.
But if the data is real, then you're more likely to have ones in there.
Yes. So you're going to get a small glimpse into my my reading habits. I'm actually received as a gift, so this was not my personal selection, but this tells you what people think about me. There's a fascinating book which I've read, which is called The Grapes of Math by Alex Bellos. And he talks about this Benford's Law as far as being just a very interesting phenomena, which has been proven, but exactly, used in court cases. And not only is one more likely than two, but two more likely than three, three more likely than four, and all the way down to nine. And it does. It's not just based. It's not just looking at digits. It looks at sort of how revenues come in to certain system, and it's really applicable in lots of different ways. But fascinating, I think, that it's actually been used in the court of law to prove cases of fraud. And hopefully our listeners can see, and we'll wrap this up in the next episode, but how math is really quite useful, not just in purely sort of theoretical realms, but how the theoretical can then sort of transfer over into the more applicable mathematics. But yeah, if you're just generating random digits from 1 to 9, you have a 10% chance. It's somewhat amazing that ones show up about 30% of the time, three times more likely than we would expect. And of course, there's math behind it. But yeah, it goes 30% for 1, 18% for 2, and diminishes from there. And just something that's somewhat fascinating to think about. And within something that seemingly would be, you know, if you just ask somebody, pick a digit between 1 and 9, it'd be 1 and 10. So in a seemingly chaotic sort of system that's at work here, there is a very defined order, so much so that people have been found guilty of fraud based on the order that they that we expect within that. And this goes to a bigger idea here, which is, can we use some of this to help predict what will happen? In some cases, we will be able to, and in other cases, and for various reasons, we may not be able to.
Right. Now let's jump to the other end of the spectrum, where instead of proving things for sure, we're pretty confident they're fake. Let's talk about conspiracy theories.
Ooh, I love conspiracy theories.
Yes.
Yeah. Everyone loves a good conspiracy theory.
Right.
Yeah,
get out your tinfoil hats. Get ready for this. This should be good. No, and we were talking about this in the last episode, so I think it's kind of fitting we get to talk about it again.
Yes.
And the idea here is that out of a lot of chaos, you can find order.
Yeah.
Right? And when you have a lot of chaos, it's likely that you'll find some order.
Absolutely.
Right? That's what we're talking about here today. And a specific example of this is in the book Moby Dick. Now, I don't know if you've seen the book Moby Dick or read it even. It's a huge book. There are a lot of words in that book.
Yes.
And if you put the words into a rectangular fashion, right? Like, you line the words up in a grid.
Yes.
Then you can find a bunch of different names of people who were killed, you know, who were assassinated. For example, I'm looking at, you know, some of these. You can find Indira Gandhi, Renee Mawad, Leon Trotsky, Martin Luther King Jr. All of these names are John F. Kennedy. All of these names, Abraham Lincoln, wow, okay. Wow. All of these.
Well, that seals it for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like yeah. Right, right.
Pushes it right over the edge.
Yeah. You can find all these names in there, right? But that's just because there's so many letters in this book. You're going to find some order. And specifically, the problem that you know these conspiracy theorists are making is that they're looking at the evidence and then creating a hypothesis instead of going to the book with a hypothesis, right?
Yes.
And this is the thing that you know, scientists try to avoid. Yes. They try to have a hypothesis before doing an experiment so that they can either confirm or reject it, right?
Wow.
And here they're doing the exact opposite.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly backwards. Right. Right. Right.
And it's the same thing with conspiracy theories in general, not just this one. What they're doing is you have all this information, right? The conspiracy theory is coming out of something that wasn't settled by fact for sure.
Correct.
And you find these snippets of information here and there and you try to create a broader picture out of it. The problem they're making there is that they're changing the story to fit the facts that they find.
Yes.
Right? Or the quote-unquote facts that they find.
Yes.
Instead of using the facts to create a story.
Yeah.
Right?
And
instead of using the story, like you get what I'm saying, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and this goes back to what we did talk about last episode, which was the importance of changing that paradigm, right? So instead of letting the facts lead you to something, you are letting the story lead you to the facts that you want to find.
Right.
Yeah. And speaking about, and we'll get back to other conspiracy theories later, but speaking about words in text, and the order that can be found within it. There's a law called Zipf's law, and basically it says that the frequency of any word is inversely proportional to its rank in the frequency table. So to put that in layperson's term, the most common word, so if you take Moby Dick, for example, and you take the most frequently used word in Moby Dick, probably the, but mm-hmm. who knows, that is maybe 13 times more likely to occur than the 13th most used word, interestingly. Not just that, it is twice as more likely to occur than the second most commonly occurring word. And as a matter of fact, if you look on the grand scale, in the English language, in the written text that we have access to, the word the is used 7% of the time, number one. And the word of, which is second, is used 3.5% of the time. And just like we know with any set of data, the more data you have, the more likely you are to converge to some result. If you take the word the and compare it to the 100th most used word, which I don't know what it is, it would occur 100 times, is 100 times more likely to occur than that. Now that's interesting on its own. But Zipf's law doesn't just apply to words and texts. It also applies to human beings and our movements within large urban areas. For example, the most populous city in the United States, most populous metropolitan district, is New York in Northeast New Jersey, ranked number one, population of 12 million. The 10th most populous city in America is Cleveland, with exactly 1/10 the population, 1.2 million. So that's interesting. You can apply it also to the 100th most population-rich area, which is, I don't know, Hamilton, Middletown, and that has 1/100 of the population of New York and New Jersey. So you would think, you know, oh, my movements are random, right? So if I decide to move today to New York, that seems like an independent decision of someone who else might be moving to New York. And yet what we know based on the macro scale of things is if two people move to New York, then to the second most populous city, one person will probably move.
We talked about this in human geography at one point.
Really?
And if I remember correctly, the formula they used was, yeah, this was the one time we used numbers in human geography.
Funny.
But we were talking about the gravity between two places, the connection. And
yeah.
And that was where you take the number of people yep. in the cities, and you multiply them together and divide by the distance squared. And if you're talking about the pull that a city has on you, right, the probability you'll go there is the people divided by the distance squared.
Interesting.
And so, for example, here in Rochester, Minnesota, the Twin Cities would have a big pull.
Sure.
Right? Because you've got a million divided by, you know, 60 squared
miles. Yes.
New York, on the other hand, is, what, 10 million?
Yeah.
Divided by, I don't know, 2,000 squared?
Yeah.
Right? And so that's how you can compare the pull that different places have.
Well, and this goes back to the bigger idea of connections that we talked about in the last episode, which is if there are 12 million people in a city, there are presumably far more connections both within that city but then outside of that city. So if I have an uncle, let's say, who lives in New York City, I'm far more likely to move there than I am to Houston, where I don't know anyone, right?
Right.
Just based on the connections that I have. It also reminds me of a gravitational pull, right? So a larger object has more pull to it. But it goes back to this idea that within a seemingly chaotic movement of people in our country and in our world, there is a very defined sense of order. Now, doesn't mean we can predict the future, but it does mean that that we can seemingly attempt to understand the movement within that system.
Right. We can't predict where one person is going to go, but we can predict the behavior of the system as a whole.
Yes.
Right. And this actually reminds me of another one of the examples we have queued up here, and that's
sure.
natural selection.
Ooh, yeah.
And so, for example, you know, I can't predict, you know, which individual is going to die and which one isn't.
Mm-mm.
But in the long run, the ones with the more favorable traits are the ones that are going to survive.
Yes.
Right. And so even a 1% increase in survival, while for a specific individual probably doesn't mean much,
right.
for the population as a whole, it converges to something.
Yes, absolutely.
And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I just used the word converge, right?
Yeah.
And we're back to math again.
We are.
Because like systems can seem weird and chaotic, but they can still converge to something.
Absolutely.
Right?
And what we're talking about here, when we talk about converging... or diverging, but specifically converging is what's happening at the end of the system, right? Not necessarily, we don't even care what's happening at the beginning because there's so few data points to work with that it doesn't really matter. But in the end, a sequence or a system can converge as we approach, let's say, time approaching infinity. Well, are we ever going to get to time being infinity? No. But the closer we get, the farther we travel along that path, a convergent series... a convergent system becomes more and more predictable and will vary less and less. And that's the same idea of the law of large numbers in a way in statistics, which is the more you approach, the larger the data set becomes, the longer time goes on, the more predictable things come, right? So we'll get back to the stock market in a while, but, you know, we have a lot of data points, right? I mean, when was the stock market sort of established? I don't know.
I can check.
Okay. So while Nikhil checks, in the first 2 years of the stock market, we had little information to go off of, right? No historical data, nothing to work. We were just sort of going on our own.
Wow, okay. So okay. The New York Stock Exchange has been around almost as long as the country, 225 years.
Okay. Okay. So for the first 5 years of the New York Stock Exchange... little was known, right? There was no history. We couldn't make predictions. And yet now over the course of 225 years, we probably have more predictions that can be made. If the system truly is, sort of has some underlying order. Now, there are other variables pulling on it, right? So the obvious counterargument is, well, if the stock market is so predictable, why isn't everyone making millions of dollars? And it's a fair question. It's because you can't truly predict what's going to happen next, right? So within that chaotic system that exists, the ups and the downs, the selling and the buying of things, there is some order, and yet we either maybe cannot understand it or maybe not everyone can understand it, right? And obviously people who are making good money off of it probably understand it a little bit better than others.
So one thing I did want to point out is that we are looking at two different ideas here. One of them is the thing about Ramsey theory from earlier, which is that you can always find order given some sort of chaos, right?
Yes.
That when you have enough elements, you can find some order in there. And what we're talking about here is a little bit different. It's still having a lot of elements, but now it's you've got this sort of time dependence in there.
Yes.
Or some sort of, you know, requirement that there be enough elements without defining exactly how many.
Yes.
And so with the party problem from earlier with six people, mm-hmm. I could say with six people for sure three people will, you know, have that property.
Yes.
But here with, you know, let's see, for example, Benford's Law, you might need either 300 data points, 3,000, you know. You can't guarantee anything.
Exactly.
Right? There's still... Or, like, for example, flipping a coin. There's still a non-zero probability you get 1,000 heads.
Yes.
Right? But, again, with Ramsey theory, you can say for sure. Yes. For sure that this is true.
Yes. Yeah, it's an important distinction that needs to be made, which is there are some things that are definitely going to be true,
right.
And some things where it's likely. And the more trials we have or the more time that passes, it almost becomes zero, but it doesn't become zero.
Yeah, the term I've heard used before, and I'm not sure if this is an academic term, is where you say it's morally true or morally false, which is saying something on the order of it's true 999 out of 1,000 times.
Sure.
So for all practical purposes, it's true.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean it's always true.
Right.
And we have to be careful. Because then, right, so suppose you're flipping a coin 10 times.
Yes.
But then you do this experiment 1,024 times.
Yes.
You might actually have... one of those trials give you 10 heads.
Yes.
Right?
That's right.
And so...
And really, as time... If you were able to flip that coin infinitely many times,
right.
You would be guaranteed to have...
Yes.
Basically guaranteed...
No, yeah, guaranteed.
...to have 10 heads in a row.
Right. So, for example, if you're flipping a coin, you know, to infinity...
Yes.
10,
for sure.
Yeah, you'll get 10. You'll get any string of... heads or tails that you want.
Yes.
Suppose I come up here and I say, I want to find it. Heads, tails.
You right? would find it.
You will find it.
Guaranteed.
It will be there.
Yes.
Right? Because and that's what happens when you go to infinity.
Yes. And this is one of the issues, not to veer too far off of the chaotic path, but within the episode, I think it's fitting. This is what happens when people try to apply real number properties to infinity, right? The idea that infinity is a number and it can be quantified. Physically speaking, if we went to infinity and we flipped coins, there would be a string of a billion heads in a row.
Right.
Okay. In the practical real world that we exist in, the physical world that we exist in, that's just not going to happen. If we're talking morally true, morally false, it's morally false.
So
a billion.
I have a good story here, I think.
Yes.
So Richard Feynman, a physicist, I believe, at Princeton, he has this story, right, he likes to do this thing,
mm-hmm.
where he'll go up to a board and recite the first 700 or so digits of pi.
Okay.
And somewhere along there, I think it's like around 750,
mm-hmm.
There are six nines in a row, right? So
yes.
He gets up there, he's continuing, he's been going for a long time, then he goes 999999 and so on.
Interesting.
So he's trying to, you know, he's making a joke there that... Because there's six nines, like, and so on, you know, it just keeps going.
Yes.
Because, you know, a lot of times in science, like, in math, for example, you all have, like, 2, 5, 2, 5, and so on, right?
Yeah, 0.333,
right.
So on.
Right.
Yeah.
But...
Interesting.
But that's one of the occurrences of this thing, right? You've got a long string of digits, an infinite string of digits, right? And somewhere in there, there's six nines.
Yes. Well, and that ties back to conspiracy theories, right? If now I want to say, well, what does that mean? That means something, right? Whatever digits those are, 750 through 755, if those digits are all nines, what does that mean?
There's a 666 somewhere in the digits of pi.
Yes, exactly. The devil's lurking within pi, as is common knowledge, because 666 is in there somewhere.
Right, and
right?
where did that conspiracy theory start from?
Who knows?
Right.
Probably, yeah. That's a whole other story. But exactly, I mean, so it's the idea of tying back to our conspiracy theories, which is taking what's known and then drawing conclusions from that, as opposed to the other way around. So, that's an interesting way to look at these seemingly random events. And if things are random, as the digits of pi, everything's going to happen within that, every possibility that we can think of,
right.
Which is certainly fascinating. But yeah, I think it's important that our listeners understand the difference between the two, which is some things can be proven, some things require larger data sets to to get their point across, I suppose.
Yeah, so another example of this would be in weather patterns, because modeling every single element in a storm or, you know, in the atmosphere is impossible.
Yes.
Right? But we try to find order out of the general chaos that's there.
Yes.
So here we have microscopic chaos, right? Because we can't predict every single thing that's going on.
No.
But we have macroscopic order.
Yes.
Because we can see these individual things coalesce into a pattern.
Yes. Right. Well, and going back to, so let's say there's a tornado, right, ripping through a community. They have made huge strides, thanks to, you know, some computer modeling, I'm sure, or meteorological science. They've made huge strides in their ability to predict where tornadoes will hit, and when to send out warnings, where to send out warnings. They've been able to more fine-tune it, right? So before, it used to just be huge blanketed areas. There's a tornado warning. Everyone head for cover. Well, inherently that, you know, if a tornado doesn't hit and I'm in a tornado warning area, enough times I start to think, these don't even matter, right? Like, oh, well, who cares? It's just another tornado warning. Yeah, I'll keep my eye on the window. But they're building more credibility with their models being more accurate. And I think it goes back to the idea that the more order that we can get, the more secure we feel, right, as humanity. If we feel like we can predict it, if we feel like we know what's going to happen or we have a sense of what's going to happen, it makes us feel more at ease sort of with what's going on. So even within a very chaotic system, that sense of order really makes us feel like, okay, yes, that is something that I can understand. And as human beings, when we can understand things, we are, I think, just rest at ease a little bit easier. A little bit better. The same thing goes with, you know, our solar system. And this, you know, this is a, I guess you could say, a debate, which has raged for a long time, which is where did the solar system come from, our universe, and all of that. If there is a sense of order within the seemingly chaotic, you know, does it lend credence to this intelligent design? Is it just, you know, mathematically and scientifically inevitable that that order will sort of arise from a chaotic situation? I guess people see it differently. But it is fascinating that again, within our solar system, a seemingly chaotic and random sort of assortment of planets and systems and that a certain sense of order does arise. When we feel like there is order, we feel like there's a plan. And a plan is something that people like to have, right? Because if we're just floating around on this rock with no plan, then for a lot of people that is troubling, that's disturbing. So I think there are a lot of chaotic things, both in weather and in solar systems, that if there isn't a sense of order, it's scary to people. I think that's fair to say. So the fact that within, you know, I think this should be a very heartening episode for a lot of people, which is in two ways, within chaotic systems there is order. And even if we can't perceive it, that order does exist and oftentimes can be quantified.
Yeah. The thing I just thought about when we were talking about the stock market a little bit earlier, what we tend to do as a society is reward the people who succeed, right? Like, that makes sense.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
And the thing that happens with doing that, though, is 99% of people don't succeed in that way, right? I'm thinking of, like, the people who become billionaires in the stock market, right?
Yeah.
There are very, very few of those, and there are a lot of people who fail. For example, people who drop out of college, right?
Sure.
They always make a big deal out of how the best people, the most successful people in the world didn't finish college, right?
Or yeah.
Many of them did.
Right.
They name people like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But you have to remember that these people are a very small percent of the people who drop out.
Yes.
And so they, dropping out of college is a high variance thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Very. Yes.
If you're dropping out of college to pursue something else, right? you're either going to make it big or fail dramatically.
Yeah. It doesn't make much of a story to say, hey, look at this, you know, college dropout who went back and got a job that they were already qualified after a high school diploma.
Right, but that's at least 99% of the people who drop out.
Probably, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But the stories we emphasize and glorify as a society are the ones where people drop out of college and succeed. Yes. Or make $1 billion in the stock market, yes. Not the ones with failure.
Right.
And I think what this does is it changes our perception of what the actual order is in the system, the actual probabilities, right?
Yes.
So the actual probabilities here might be 99 to 1, but when we hear all these success stories, we think it's like 20 to 80,
yes. Right? Right, right. So I've got a chance.
Yeah, got a chance, and that mentality.
It's the same thing with the lottery.
Right.
Sure, there is a chance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the likely scenario.
But that's the thing with variance and long-term probabilities, right? Sure, for the lottery, your long-term probability is horrible. But the variance is high.
Yes.
So for example, if you need, for some reason, $1 million tomorrow and you have $1 right now,
yes.
The only way you're going to get it is to buy a lottery ticket.
Yes. And let's be honest. A lot of people feel like they need money tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I could take my dollar, you know, people say, well, you should have invested your money. Okay, that's something that winners, quote, societal winners call societal losers, to say, well, if you'd done it like me, you'd be fine. Well, that may be true in the long term, and it would be true in the long term. The small scale is, okay, that's fine, but I have no education, or little education. I'm in a dead-end job, and I've got $2. You want me to invest $2? Okay, I'm not going to go down to Edward Jones and say, here's $2, start a money market account for me, or invest this in a Roth IRA. I'm gonna buy a hot dog and a lottery ticket, right? Because that's gonna make me feel better, and it's gonna make me feel like I have a chance. And really, in the short term, there is more of a chance, not a great chance, but more of a chance, certainly. In going that route than taking it down to Edward Jones, because, you know, in 10 years, you'll have $4 instead of two. Great. Great. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is important that we understand that on a human level, and that's a good point that you make, on a very individualized and human level, there is a difference between what the best route is statistically and you know, no one says, go to college and drop out because then you could do this. The long-term goal, of course, and the route to success on the grand scale is go to college, gain some skills, get a degree, and get a job that's going to pay you well. It's going to give you some skills and give you some options. But that's not necessarily the case for every individual. It doesn't mean it's the route that is recommended, but it is a route that, some people inevitably, and with such a large sample, it's basically bound that people will drop out of college and be successful, right? I mean, statistically speaking, it would be highly improbable if that didn't happen, right? Nearly impossible. So it doesn't mean it's a recipe for success. It doesn't mean that's the route that people should be going. But you can see on an individual scale how that could be.
Since this has devolved into statistics, one thing I want to mention, again, we're talking about perception of statistics, right?
Of course, yes.
And one of the things that always comes to mind for me is how we don't interpret statistics correctly, I guess, right?
Okay, can I throw out one pet peeve before you go?
Yeah.
The next time I see 0% chance of rain on the Weather Channel, it just drives me crazy, right? And, of course, as it's happened to a lot of people, we had a nice day planned. We at the Johnson household still hang up clothes on the line. So we hadn't hung up because there's 0% chance of rain. It's impossible, even though we know that's not true, literally impossible that it will rain. Put all clothes on the line. We go over and sure enough, rain comes. So, that perception of statistics, go ahead, hit it. But yeah, it's something. It's a pet peeve. It's not the end of the world, obviously, some wet clothes, but statistics are something I think that are misrepresented often.
Right. And I guess the reason that they're doing it is they're probably rounding, right?
Of course.
They don't want to see a 3% chance of rain anyway.
Right, or a 0.8% chance of rain. Right.
It's just a little more intuitive.
Yes.
You see zero.
Of course. Right.
But yeah.
Yes. Yes.
It's not zero.
It's there. We know it's not zero.
Right.
Yes.
And so the thing I wanted to mention is how we're so bad at, let's see, intuitively thinking about averages.
Ooh,
I guess is the way
sure.
I put it.
Sure.
For example, the average person has fewer than two arms.
This is true.
Yeah.
Yes.
But most people, when they hear that, are very confused.
Yes.
Because you're thinking median.
Yes.
Right? At least intuitively, that's what you're thinking, right?
Yes.
Like, average has a different colloquial meaning than it does mathematical.
Absolutely.
But when you see it in a survey or, you know, in the news, average is the mathematical definition.
Yes. Or it should be.
It should be.
But not how we use it.
No.
No.
The way we use it is like, oh, if I were just to pick someone off the street, how many arms did they have? It's
right.
two, right?
Right.
But the mathematical definition is add them all up and divide by the number, right?
Yes. Oftentimes we use median and mode.
Yeah.
Or we use average in place of median and mode.
Right.
Right. I mean, and that's... Right. So it is a dichotomy. It's a difference
mm-hmm.
in real statistics, mathematical statistics, and... just kind of how we use it. Yeah, no doubt about it.
Right. So these kinds of statistical fallacies, I guess, are a problem, right? Because when we're talking about the average in some group, this is why we talk about median household income, for example.
Sure, absolutely.
There's so many things that skew average income.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
And those are the things we have to be careful of when
right.
we talk about statistics. Or, for example, what actually bothers me is when people say that, you know, two candidates are like 3% off, and the margin of error is 3%. And then it becomes a huge news story, right? Because these two candidates are within the margin of error.
Statistically tied.
That's not true. That's not what statistically tied means.
Right. No, like, no, it does not. Well, and the other thing, to get back to your skewing and average, let's take a small town of 5,000 people,
mm-hmm.
and the richest person in the world moves to that town. What just happened to the average household income? Through the roof. Right, through the roof. What happened to the median? Now, one person moving into a community does affect the community, but it doesn't change it by, I don't know the math behind it, but that would take probably a median an average household income of, let's say, $50,000. And if someone is making billions of dollars a year, it would assuredly double it, right? Did that community just get twice as rich with that one person moving in? Probably not. Now, are there some other opportunities? Yes. But this is where I think, especially devolving into statistics, you can use statistics to say whatever you want it to say.
Right.
And I've seen enough terrible bar charts and enough just hideous circle graphs to know that whether people are doing it or not, they use statistics to push an agenda oftentimes. And sometimes it's not even with ill intent. It's just they find something that sort of backs up what they're trying to say, and they don't even necessarily disregard the other numbers that sort of indicate a different story or a more complex story. And oftentimes we just boil it down to, well, this is it. This is what's going on.
One other thing, for example, very related to that is where we ignore the actual sample being, I guess, sampled.
Sure.
Right? For example, when you have two groups that you're comparing, right? Let's just say the 2016 electorate and the 2000 electorate.
Sure.
Or 2000 might be a bad example here. Let's go with 1996.
Okay.
Right? Now, both of these were victories for, you know, one candidate.
Yes.
Without serious contention about the results.
Yes.
And both candidates probably, I don't know the exact numbers, can probably claim they won either the most votes in history or something very close to it.
Sure, yes.
But the thing that everyone forgets is that the samples have changed, right?
Yes.
Now we have way more people that are voting, right?
Of course.
So that claim is disingenuous, right?
Right, yes.
And it's the same thing where you always forget the sample that you're considering changes, or that the sample that you're considering is different from the other sample you're considering.
Yes.
For example, we'll often look at, certain demographics in the population, right?
Yep.
We'll say, like, this demographic believes this, and this demographic believes that, right?
Yes.
On average or percentages. But we forget that one demographic is significantly larger than the other.
Yes.
Right? And that can mean things.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And we ignore the underlying structure and just try to break things down to find order that might not exist.
Yeah. Well, and just another situation where statistics are very easily manipulated. And you can look at what you want to look at. I have a former student who works at the EPA who sent me a video. He was doing some research if you look at how pollution is sort of spread throughout our communities, is there a disproportionate amount of pollution, of particulates, that certain subgroups of our population are exposed to as opposed to others. And near the conclusion, I won't give you the entire spiel, but news alert, if you are black or if you are living in poverty, you are more likely to live near power plants and therefore be exposed to harmful chemicals. But at the conclusion of the video that he sent me, he did state that over the course of from the year about 2000 to 2014, there has been a decrease in the amount of pollution in urban centers, which is good news, right? So the issue, of course, comes from when you break it down by subgroups. Every subgroup went down, but some subgroups went down more than others, right? So the white subgroup went down by more than the African-American subgroup, meaning basically that the gap is widening, right? So while the picture, if I'm someone who thinks or prescribes to the belief that, hey, it's going down for everyone, that's good, then I can use the statistics to say that. If I'm someone who says, hey, There is a racial element here that can't be ignored, then I can maybe use those statistics, if I were so inclined to pursue that agenda. I think it's important that when dealing with any statistics that we try to take the long view, which he did a great job of. He really looked at various data points at various times from various lenses, but to take in the whole picture, right, when we're looking at situations that, and this is where, speaking of chaos, when you look at the maps he was looking at, they are seemingly chaotic, right? There is, it's hard to pull order from that, but it takes some mathematical rigor to be able to identify trends. And the more complex the system, the more chaotic the system is, the harder it is to find that randomness or to find that order, right? So I think it's incumbent upon mathematicians and scientists of all stripes to dig into that because, again, if you're looking to actually fix issues, and this is an issue that he found and addressed was if you are black as opposed to white, you are expected to be exposed to 50% more, basically, pollution, regardless of socioeconomic or other issues that may affect where you live. So he even was able to sort of pull that data out and identify it, which I think is powerful. But it's not an easy job, right? Yeah.
The other example I'm thinking of is where, very related, right? Crime rates have gone down for a long time now.
Yeah, that's right.
But last year went up relative to the year before that.
Sure.
And so this is where people start spinning it.
Oh, yes.
So there are two sides to this, and they're both valid, right? They're not misinterpretations.
No.
They're just giving off different perceptions of the data, right?
To push an agenda.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the people who want increased policing on crime, right, will say, oh, look, crime went up.
Yes.
And went up by a decent percentage, if I remember right, too.
Sure.
Because relative to the year before, it was just a higher percent.
Yes.
If you're talking about the rate of change here.
Yes.
But overall, it's still significantly down from when, people can remember as, times of high crime.
Yes.
Right. And so we're ignoring the bigger picture to look at the smaller picture. And that has value too, like if you want to talk about the current trends and what we need to do right now, but we also have to remember that in the long term things have been working, and according to our, you know, our usual theories about chaos and order, there will be some variance from year to year when you start leveling out.
Of course. Right?
And so now we're probably approaching a point where the crime rate is going to level out a little bit, and so we'll get a little bit of an increase.
Yes.
It doesn't mean our policies aren't working in general. It just means that they might be leveling out. They just didn't have the intended effect last year. We don't have enough data points to signify that it's not working.
Yes. Now, if crime were increasing 7 years in a row,
yeah,
be a different story, potentially, right? Then we could look at our policies and say, this isn't quite working. The other interesting thing, speaking about small things, this is something where, you know, you could say there's a 50% increase in crime, but if crime was very, very low, that's not that hard to achieve, mm-hmm. right? I think of an example, or school district implemented a program where we had to give pre- and post-tests, and the pre-test you would give before you taught the unit, you would teach, and then you would take a post-test. The students would take a post-test. Well, I distinctly remember one case, and we had a specialist come in, and we were looking at our results, and I had a student who got a 1 out of 10 on a multiple choice test on her pretest. Obviously not very good. I taught her, we did the best we could, and she got a 3 out of 10 on the post test. And it said, of course, on the report, 200% improvement. Okay, and this the person from the district was lauding the huge improvements that were made. Anyone who knows anything about mathematics, 4 questions, multiple choice, 10 questions, 4 multiple choice, to get a 3 out of 10 is not a huge achievement. As a matter of fact, it's what's expected if you know nothing, right? So it's where, you know, and that is valued far less than someone who went from a 7 out of 10 to a 9 out of 10. Right? So the differences in data sets matter. And when we start to, you know, this was a person who was pushing the program, wanted it to look good, and said, look, even your bottom students are achieving 200% the levels of prior.
Do you think that's why districts try a little extra to help students at the bottom than they do at the top? Do you think that's part of it, or is it more moral and, I guess, ethical?
Well, so I have sat in meetings where school districts have a finite amount of resources.
Right.
And let's just say you have students coming in who are going to take an MCA test, a state-mandated test. And the school district needs to get as many of these students to pass as possible. If the benchmark is passing, and let's say we have one class that we can offer to 30 kids, who should we put in that class? Well, we have their expected scores. Just from a planning standpoint, we were deciding to offer those interventions to the 30 students who fell right below the line, which makes sense. From a just trying to get as many kids as we have the resources to pass, right? So if they're projected to be 1149 and we need them to be 1150 to pass, we should invest resources into 1149 kids. Right. Because an 1149 is a 0, a fail, and 1150 is a 1, it's a win. They're easier to change, obviously, to 1150s than kids who are at 1102. Mm-hmm. Now, if the goal is growth, that's a different story, right? Then you might pick different kids because there may be more room to grow from an 1102 than 1149. I don't know that for sure. But it's interesting in how you look at data sets to decide where you're going to use your limited resources. If it was, we can offer as many classes as there are, that's a different issue. But how often is that the case? There are always some limiting factors to what you can do. I think from a school district standpoint, this idea of, and this is a whole other story, but there are many people who use statistics in misleading ways. And then it leads to policies which aren't even addressing actual concerns, or if they are actual concerns, don't address them in a way that is reasonable or sound. That going back to our idea of, well, maybe I'll save this for episode 10. This is a bit of a teaser. We recently in an organization I'm a part of had a vote. We'll save this for our recap episode in episode 10. So make sure you tune in. But and Nikhil, don't let me forget this idea of what a very bad vote can look like, and how a seemingly intelligent group of people can vote in a hideous and atrocious way. It's going to be good. I think our listeners are going to appreciate it. But to go back to the idea of misleading data, it is a problem and it is an issue. And the idea that we draw conclusions from things that we think we're making conclusions that are correct that are not, is something that we certainly need to take a look at.
Yeah, so we'll save your story about the bad vote for next time.
Yeah.
And I think this has been a good episode overall.
Yep.
I think we've covered a lot of things we didn't expect to cover. We started off with chaos and order and that kind of thing, and we ended up with statistical anomalies and fallacies. So
yeah, no, I think, you know, it's probably the most math-heavy episode that we have, but we are math people, so it was bound to come up at some point. And I hope our listeners found it to be valuable. And really, I think the biggest issue that we're trying to address over the course of this, and we'll talk about this more next episode, is maybe just changing the way we think about systems, and maybe in a bit more logical and mathematically rigorous way, just to analyze the way we're doing things. So, hopefully our listeners found it valuable. We appreciate all of you who are listening. And if you have any comments, please hit us up. We love hearing feedback and appreciate those comments. So keep them coming. We'll be here for the last episode of the season, episode 10, which will be a recap over the 9 episodes that we've covered so far, and maybe some things that have changed and things we've experienced since then.
Yeah, we've had some thoughts change for sure. And we've also had other conversations about things we talked about.
Yep.
We've talked to people who have listened to our podcast and gotten some input from them.
Yeah.
And so we kind of want to bring all of that together, maybe tie in some episodes and how they relate.
Yeah.
So I think the next episode is going to be an interesting one, and one definitely not worth missing, especially if you've been with us for the past 9.
That's right. Cherry on top of the wonderful cake that we've had here. So, yeah, make sure you tune in, and thanks for listening.